Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. For months, we've been told Kyiv is preparing a counteroffensive to regain lost territory and that Ukraine will eventually become a member of NATO. But recently, we're told to curb any expectations the Ukraine assault will achieve anything. Then, what is the point of the counteroffensive? Crosstalking counteroffensives, I'm joined by my guest, Andrei Martyanov in Washington State. He's a writer as well as a military and political analyst. In Lisbon, we have Alexander Guerrero. He is an international legal analyst. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Andrei, let me go to you first in Washington. I mean, we've been hearing this now for months, and it's the weather. We need more trucks. We need more tanks, you know, have lower expectations. And then, to top it all off, well, we're actually thinking more about the next offensive, not this one. I mean, what is going on, or is this just a psyop? Go ahead, Andrei.
As any serious military does in operational planning, it calculates required force to do anything. In Washington, who is really running the and I'm talking about Washington, D.C., not beautiful Washington State, and where they run this campaign, basically. It's Pentagon, and in London, they do planning. Everything is pointed towards and honed for one purpose only. It's PR. Basically, Ukraine and whatever is left of the armed forces of Ukraine are the hostages of the internal politics in the United States, specifically of the Democratic National Committee and those people in the Democratic Party who want to re-elect whatever or whoever they want to re-elect and stay in power. And for that, they have to have some kind of the foreign policy success against the background of the catastrophic failure across the board, all over the place. And now they need the offensive to show that, you see, you know, we have offensive. Obviously, none of them, including evidently political generals in Pentagon, understand what modern combined arms warfare is. Those people lost all their wars. Their doctrinal development in the United States in the last 20, 30 years was anything but normal. It was insane. And when you look at this, this is what they have to have. It's PR. They need to have some kind of movement on the front while Russia sits in the strategic defense and waits for, you know, while the remnants of the armed forces of Ukraine will impale themselves at their defense. That's it.
Okay, I want to get to Russia's offensive a little bit later here. Let me go to Alexander in Lisbon. I mean, the way I read it, and I've been watching Andrei's videos, his podcasts, and, you know, I think it's a lot of PR. I think it's also fundraising. There's never enough. We need more money. We need more this. We need more that, okay? End user issues. Everybody turns a blind eye, which I think Europe is going to truly regret that one day. But Alexander, I mean, the way it's phrased here is that to regain lost territory, that is very vague here. And then what? You regain some lost territory, and then what? Okay, this is a politics without any kind of goal. Okay, and that's what makes me say in the beginning, talking to Andrei, this is like a psych-op operation. I mean, it doesn't seem very real. What is real is a lot of people are dying, and that's very, very tragic for all concerned. Go ahead, Alexander.
Indeed, but the main problem regarding this so-called counteroffensive, first, is the scope of the expression counteroffensive itself, in order to determine how and to what extent it will be perpetrated or not by Kyiv. So we don't know yet if this counteroffensive will be pursued and perpetrated in a way that it will cover the entire front line, some parts, or only a few parts. And actually, what we are looking presently is that the recent Ukrainian troop movements and deployments, as well as the evacuations conducted by the Russian forces in some Zaporozhye areas, actually, they reveal that the announced counteroffensive may have already begun. In fact, if we look at the more recent news, we see that since yesterday, Ukrainians were trying and are still trying to break the defensive lines in the southern area of Artyomovsk, intending to head to Kleshivka village, and also Ivanivsky, while the Wagner group was forcing and putting some pressure on Ukrainians in Stupochki. We have to wait if Ukrainian forces will be able to hold their positions here. And actually, in case they can, if they will try to take advantage of this success or not, in order to launch other counterattacks from the flanks, especially if we consider that this direction was previously pointed out by Yevgeny Prigozhin as likely for an offensive by Ukrainian troops. Yet, at the same time, today, we heard that the United Kingdom was about to provide long-range missiles for Ukraine that might be able to cover the entirety of the territory of Crimea. So now the main question I believe that we must make is, are they going to start a counterattack in the entirety of the front line, or they can consider this itself, the present attacks in Artyomovsk, as a counteroffensive, and they don't want to commit themselves with the announcement of very ambitious goals that are likely to fail?
Yeah, well, Andrei, I think that, you know, one of the things that the media has done in framing this conflict that never should have happened in the first place is about territory. It's not really about territory. It's about destroying the military capacity of Ukraine slash NATO, because this is a NATO war against Russia. And so I think that, you know, all this hype about taking this town or this region, I think it's superfluous. I think it's a waste of time, because if we go back to the original goals, demilitarization and denazification. The denazification issue is getting rid of the Zelensky regime, and that will happen when there's a complete military collapse. Andrei.
Well, you nailed it pretty much. There's very little to add here. And again, as if you look attentively what they're doing, they don't have required force to mount any meaningful offensive. And again, we have to understand there is a very profound difference between attack and offensive. Offensive is something which pursues a specific objectives in the depending on the scale of the thing. But attack is merely movement. It is a maneuver, you know, how we approach our objective and engage enemy forces. They don't have required force. Maximum they can hope for are local tactical successes, which will be along the first line of defense. There are around three lines of defense by Russian Ministry of Defense, by Russian armed forces. So, and we already see that basically they don't have force. They don't have air force, anything which takes off from any kind of their strip in within the Ukraine is being shut down immediately, almost, you know. Yeah. They know how to take off. They don't know how to land anymore. And I'm not exaggerating here. They don't have proper air defense. They don't have proper set of their armor, which, of course, some kind of hodgepodge collection of all kinds of their, you know, NATO pieces. And when you look at this, the only thing they have, what is left, probably on one operational direction. So, and one operational direction is being clearly seen as Zaporozhye, the axis, so to speak. Yeah, they might throw a lot of bodies, you know, a lot of cannon fodder. And territory in this case is nothing more than in the Great Patriotic War would have been stated as the fights of the local significance. Yeah, they might gain killer.
Yeah, Alexander, to this point right here, you mentioned these long-range missiles here. One of the interesting things is that all these missile systems that are vaunted, you know, the high-tech and all of that, I've talked to military people, and they're not as good as they claim, and they were always designed to fight in the Middle East against, you know, goat herders, okay? Not against a peer power militarily. And I think, again, this is a lot of posturing on the side of the West, is it that, you know, the blank check approach here. I mean, they keep saying this because they have no other alternative. They've actually backed themselves into a corner. Alexander.
Yes, indeed. Actually, considering this present situation and also the importance that such counteroffensive, if there will be any counteroffensive with a strong impact on the, at least on the Ukrainian side, this may have for the future of Kiev authorities as well. It will have also a huge impact to the West as a whole. So it is highly expectable that Western political representatives actually they are not unveiling any kind of plans, maybe because they don't have any concrete plans. They have expectations. They have been feeding, they have been funneling a lot of money and a lot of weapons to this kind of a counteroffensive that has been delayed since last summer, if you remember. So actually, what we know is that Western leaders, they know exactly that Ukrainian forces, they are not as well prepared as they wanted them to be. And that it is highly unlikely that with the equipment provided is not enough to be successful in any counteroffensive against Russia's manpower and equipment. Also, because this time, the Russians are not willing to withdraw and to leave the territory that it's under their control, like on the contrary, like they did in the past. So here, presently, the West is facing is in a crossroads. They have to choose. We must take a risk. We have to try all kind of different military solutions, even if we can try this these long-range missiles. However, if it becomes successful, perfect. We will try to exploit this solution. However, if it doesn't become, if it doesn't bring any kind of success, well, then we need to start looking at other solutions or find a way to leave the Ukrainians alone on this conflict, because we don't have any more capacity to keep feeding these kind of efforts by the Ukrainian military.
Alexander, at some point, and I think we're pretty close to it, manpower in Ukraine is being exhausted. I mean, what troops are they going to have, okay? I mean, this is, the U.S. can print all the money it wants, okay? And Europe can give all its old hardware it wants for free, getting rid of it. But you can't replace men. That's the issue here. Gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on counteroffensive. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing counteroffensives. Okay, now we're joined by Gilbert Doctorow in St. Petersburg. He's an independent political analyst and author of Memoirs of an Expat Manager in Moscow during the 1990s. Welcome to the program, Gilbert. I'm glad you made it. If it's only the second half, but you're always welcome on this program. Gilbert, in the first part of the program, we were talking about the real or unreal counteroffensive that everybody's talking about, been talking about for months, and curb your expectations or enthusiasm, if I can use that term, on this program. But what about what Russia is going to do? Because, Gilbert, you're in St. Petersburg, I'm here in Moscow, and let's be honest, there's frustration. This thing keeps going on, and we know the deficiencies of the Ukrainian military. We know possibly with these Pentagon leaks, I don't put a whole lot of stock into them, but we can throw that into the mix. What about Russia's offensive? Go, Gilbert.
Well, I think these two issues are very closely related. It's hard to speak about the Russian counteroffensive or counter-counteroffensive without looking at where Ukraine is and without taking into consideration the item that you were discussing just before the end you broke for me. The point is what happened today, the announcement of the delivery of these cruise missiles by Britain to the Ukrainian forces. That is a game changer. Mr. Sunak is playing the same extremely destructive role as his predecessor, Boris Johnson. Johnson wrecked the peace talks in March 2022, and Sunak is intervening in the counteroffensive stage of Ukraine in a way that is equally destructive because it imposes on Russia new conditions and game-changing conditions. By that I mean, I think the Russians will have to reconsider what they already were putting into place, and I assume they were putting into place measures to introduce the more destructive and heavier equipment, more modern equipment than they had used previously in this campaign. The introduction of cruise missiles, which can strike Sevastopol, is a different story. And I don't quite agree with fellow panelists who expressed some sympathy for the limited options of Western military planners or for the strategists sitting in Kiev. I think that the first such missile, which makes it through Russian defenses and attacks Sevastopol or the Crimea in any way, or another major city in the bordering area of Russia and Ukraine, I think that will change entirely the nature of this war and head us very well in the direction of World War III.
Yeah, but keeping in mind what Gilbert just said there, let me go back to Andrei in Washington State here. Kiev's goal, obviously, is to widen the conflict. I mean, I think the Zelensky gang, I mean, if we're going to go down, everybody has to go down with this, okay? Unfortunately, there are lunatics in Washington that may be interested in that proposition here because of their just visceral hatred of Russia. This is not about geopolitics. If it were, this thing never would have started. Go ahead, Andrei.
Yeah, there is no geopolitical, real serious geopolitical consideration anymore. It is the desperation. And about World War III, let me put it this way. When we had the situation with the HMS Defender, which was had enough arrogance to appear near Russian territorial waters a year and a half ago, you remember that, and I quote Vladimir Putin, next time we will sink it. So, and the question is, in terms of the escalation, which of course some forces in Washington and London seek. I mean, in the end, what decides is escalation dominance. And I have to politely disagree with Gilbert, but this is not a game changer. It's what is expected. And that is why they do this contingency planning. And there are no dummers in the Russian general staff. So it is expected, it was always expected, and that's how the planning was. And I can say only simple thing, okay, Medvedev, Mr. Medvedev, former president of Russia and deputy secretary of the Security Council, he's on record. He stated if you give them 300 kilometer range and longer missiles, remove the border, you know, in accordance. And that's what's going to happen. So, and as per London, and as I already stated, if it comes down that there will be leakers, any cruise missile which penetrates the air defense is called leaker, and it's going to be obviously against Sevastopol, I would say Royal Navy may indeed, you know, have some issues with the number of the hulls. And this is not in lightly stated words, because this is where it's kind of implied. And England or United Kingdom, for all its efforts to stay relevant, United States will not come to the aid. Because, well, I or record, you can quote me on this. And this is, there are no resources, realistically, except for the...
Okay, Alexander, in Lisbon, I don't know if you saw it, I hope you did, is that Stoltenberg had an interview with the Washington Post a few days ago. It was one of the stupidest things I've ever read in my life. I mean, never being asked a hard question. He said, you know, NATO's involvement in Ukraine since 2014. I thought they weren't in Ukraine. I thought they weren't a co-belligerent. I mean, this was just asinine. I mean, this man is just, you know, a mental cripple. But he made it very clear, and I think he's obviously he is a cutout for Washington to some degree, London. But, you know, Ukraine will become a member of NATO. Well, then that means this conflict will end on the battlefield, okay, because that is something that, from the very, very beginning, Russia's made clear will not happen here. So it's really interesting how, you know, you have a NATO general secretary just willing to just throw Ukraine under the bus. Because with that kind of mentality, there will be no Ukraine left. Go ahead, Alexander.
Well, actually, Stoltenberg was just confirming all the not only the ideas, but also the perception
Such a good word. He was performing. You're absolutely right. He was a performer. I'm sorry to interrupt. Go ahead, Alexander.
Not only him, but also, if you remember, Angela Merkel, as well as François Hollande, all of them actually admitted that the time to reach an agreement for the Minsk agreements was just to gain time. So this wasn't a decision taken only on that moment. It was previously planned that they wanted to achieve this kind of goals and to be present in Ukraine. They wanted a regime change in Ukraine in order to bring finally Ukraine not only to the European Union, from where they knew that they were not any longer be able, that they wouldn't be able any longer to get away from the European Union, but they also wanted Ukraine to become dependent of the NATO. So actually, this isn't no surprise. They all have been performing from not only since 2014, but it started actually previously. If we take a look at the register of the hearings of Jeffrey Piat, the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, we can see that even in 2013, he already admitted all this. So it's not a surprise, only for people here in the West that are still trying to support the idea that actually this conflict only started in February 2022. Well, let me tell you, it hasn't. It has started way before that time and also way before the Euromaidan. So actually, this is no surprise because they had to find a way in order to bring some kind of imbalance of power in Europe. So that's the reason why I see that actually he admitted something that we all already knew.
Well, you know what else he admitted? He didn't say it directly, but it obviously his words speak for themselves, is that, you know, the NATO's involvement in Ukraine since 2014. So I guess it wasn't an unprovoked attack, because using his own words, he nullifies the claim of an unprovoked attack. Gilbert.
Well, yes, I agree with your point. I agree with the stupidity of Stoltenberg's remarks, his incautiousness in actually contradicting the whole narrative that Washington has been setting out now for several years, that they had no role and that this was unprovoked. However, what I'm concerned is that events are running away with themselves, and this is consciously the action of London. I don't see how Russia can move the border back to 250 kilometers in any short period of time, when discussions of the last several months have shown that it could take months, if not years, before Russia, at its present force level in Ukraine, rolls back the Ukrainians to the Dnieper and beyond. So the British act has jumped over all of us. And I think that, as I say, if there's an attack on Russian homeland, and particularly on the Crimea, I think that the Kremlin's hand will be forced.
I agree.
And there will be a change in this war.
I agree. Andrei, speak to that, okay? I mean, it's one thing to be having a conflict in Ukraine itself, but, I mean, if major cities in Crimea are attacked, that to use Gilbert's words, forces a hand. What do you think, Andrei?
I will not disclose any kind of secret here. Sevastopol is under attacks constantly. It's constantly under attacks. Literally every week, you have the flight of all kinds of the UAVs. You have the surface UAVs just recently, last week, I believe. There were another attack of the high-speed boats, robot boats, which are unmanned surface vehicles. So Sevastopol is kind of living with that. And again, we have to look at the purely tactical, technological issue here. Will they get a little bit more complex targets? Yes, they will, absolutely. But this is, we have to understand, Crimea is being attacked constantly.
Okay, Alexander, if I can go to you before to wrap up here, last 30 seconds here. Neither side is going to give up. That's the problem, isn't it? 30 seconds, my friend, go ahead.
It's highly unlikely to have any kind of agreement when we have such a difference and such an abyss separating both parties. None of them are willing and available to cede and to quit off any kind of point. And because there isn't one single point where the parties can get closer, I believe that the only solution is to one of the parties to end with a huge defeat on the ground.
There you go. All right, gentlemen, fascinating discussion. Tragic, unfortunately, but that's where we are. I want to thank my guests in Washington State, Lisbon, and in St. Petersburg. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk rules.